Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production.
Now available on Apple Podcasts,
Podcast One,
Spotify,
and anywhere else you get your podcasts.
Welcome to the MIP.
Yeah!
The Michael Irvin Podcast.
You knew this was coming.
Guess who? Who started this thing off?
Join me every week for the Michael Irvin Podcast. We'll give you the full MIP experience. I'm talking everything from football to fashion. I will be chopping it up with playmakers, headline makers, and I am throwing haymakers. I'm the MVP of the MIP. Don't miss it.
Download new episodes of the MIP, the Michael Irvin Podcast, every Thursday on Apple Podcasts, Podcast One, and Spotify.
Welcome to Real GM Radio. I am Danny Leroux, your host. So happy to have you with us for this episode. My guest is Adam Mares of DNVR, one of my go-to people, especially when I want to talk about the Nuggets, but honestly when I want to talk about anything, and had a great conversation talking about Nikola Jokic's MVP season, Michael Porter Jr.'s sophomore campaign, where the Nuggets go from here, and so much more. Quick apology, I didn't notice at the time, but my microphone cord was loose, so I was actually using my computer's mic rather than my actual microphone, so the audio quality is a little bit worse on my end than usual. Should still be, you know, good enough, but just wanted to note that at the outset, and apologies for that. Conversation runs about an hour. Hope you really enjoy it.
Thanks so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, I mean, you've always been in demand for me, but you're a more in demand guest right now for a variety of reasons. One being that you are, as always, a great podcast guest, but one of them being that the team that you are follow the most closely has the presumptive and deserving MVP on it. And while Jokic has been great for years now, this is something Nate and I were talking about in terms of whether Jokic should be heavily considered for most improved player. And I guess instead of putting my thoughts on it first, I will open the floor to you. Like, how do you think about Jokic in the most improved player conversation?
Well, first, let me say, it's funny you said, you know, in demand, because when the Nuggets got Aaron Gordon and they went on a winning streak, got some impressive wins, there was a week there where I was getting the phone calls and texts nonstop and, hey, can you do this? Are you interested in doing this? And I was like, oh, man, this is great. You know, the Nuggets center stage, I get to come here. And then when Murray went down, it's like, okay, they all stopped. And it was the Nuggets moved back to the back burner. And it's like, oh, geez, it was a fun week. But to answer your question about Jokic, this is a funny one for me, to be honest, Dan, because there are aspects of his game that have really improved, namely just his aggression as a scorer. And I think a lot of that does come from his body. It's funny, he had a funny quote as the season began maybe it was actually in the bubble, where somebody asked him about losing weight and you used to talk about how your weight served you in the post. Do you miss it at all? And he said, yeah, that's just something I said so you guys wouldn't keep asking questions about it.
That's amazing.
It's just like the most hilarious answer. And I actually think that that's the biggest difference, is before he could be this level of dominant, but sort of like pacing himself. And now he's just, it's not inconsequential that he had the second shortest offseason of anybody. The Lakers and Heat had the shortest, but, you know, him like a week less than them, came in better shape, the best shape of his life, and then is going to, it looks like, knock on wood, play in every single game this season. Because I do think that Jokic is one of the best conditioned athletes in the NBA. And it's funny that people won't say that, but I'll say it because I watch the guy play 34, 35 minutes a night every single game and play at a high level even into the fourth quarters.
Yeah, and unlike some people, when he commits what Nate and I call Euro fouls, you know, even though Europe has basically legislated them out, his are more frustration rather than fatigue. You know, it's more like, hey, I'm pissed off, I don't want to do this, or like I want more time to yell at the refs rather than oh, I can't make it down the floor, I'm just gonna, like, and there are some guys who do that, and, you know, as long as it doesn't get you into problems, it's not the worst. I don't love it, but, you know, get in there. But you brought up something in there. I mean, playing in every game, or, you know, close to it, if he ends up, you know, missing one for some sort of suspicious reasons, that's an important part of his value. But also, Jokic playing 35 minutes a game, like, that's another, you know, it's when you talk about, like, this came up, you know, most improved or most valuable player is value. Being on the floor is not only is it, hey, you're a great player, like, being out there is better, but also that's fewer minutes that the team has to manage without you. And the Nuggets backup center roulette has been notable this year. Now, some of it looked worse just because they didn't have the kind of the Green Millsap combination as available. And so then you had to trust the other guys more. But 35 minutes a game for 69 games so far, and that will bump up, you know, the games played will bump up. Minutes per game, we'll have to see. And that, you know, that if a player is the most valuable or in the conversation offensive player in the league, you know, being on the floor for over 2,400 minutes in a 72-game season is exceedingly important. And that has been even more important, I would argue, for the Nuggets just because in the, let's call it the last couple months, just because of the other absences in the front court. Now, if you were to tell me that basically any other team, their starting point guard and their backup point guard would be hurt at the same time, one out for the season and the other out for indefinite periods of time, you'd be like, oh, their offense is going to be completely screwed. And a part of what makes, you know, like the value over replacement player is that Jokic is, he's the hub. He can run the offense. So not only is it, you know, like they've survived. I mean, they've done better with Jamal Murray out than I ever expected. But
can I speak to one aspect of that though, real quick?
Sure.
Because I think it actually hints at part of Jokic's value. It's his adaptability, and I think this is the big thing: is he did have a specific style of playing when Jamal Murray was on the court, and it was a lot of two-man game, a lot of pick and roll, a lot of back and forth between them, but. It wasn't just Murray went down, as you mentioned, also Monte Morris, also Will Barton, the starting shooting guard, and then also now PJ Dozier, the backup shooting guard. So the entire first string and second string backcourt going down, and you talk about, well, now Michael Porter all of a sudden has really stepped up, and Campazzo has really come along and looks great. And it's a testament to those guys, but I think it's also a testament to Jokic to saying, okay, I can't play the same way with Campazzo as I did with Jamal Murray, so I got to play a different style. But immediately, and when I say immediately, I mean literally the next game, changing the style of play to fit those guys, and it's succeeding. And I think that's the one thing people probably, unless you watch every single night, you just think it's like, oh, they're doing the same thing, plug a new guy in. Like, no, the Nuggets have reinvented their style of play around Jokic. He's still the hub, just a hub in a different way, and it works almost as well as it did with Murray.
Yeah, which is truly incredible. And Jokic is it's so interesting that the top, like, as I see it, and I know that there are others who disagree, and more power to them, that to me the top two players in the MVP conversation are Jokic and Steph Curry, both of whom are these supernovas offensively that have defensive limitations, and we'll get into that for both of them. But part of what I love about that race, and it gets into part of why I love basketball, why even though it was the sport I got into last, it's been what my analysis is in and everything else, is because these two unbelievable talents, both built completely differently, and they succeed in very different ways, albeit in, you know, like there are elements that you could say are somewhat similar. And a part of it is that something that I love about Jokic, and part of why he's one of my favorite players to watch, and I could say ever for me because I've, you know, only been following basketball closely for 15 years, but he probably would be anyway, is that Jokic to me, offensively, it's not only the idea that he has no weaknesses, like there are lots of other guys that are good, it's that it's so hard to take him away. Now, like there are other guys who are very talented, and you could argue maybe like, oh, if they're, you know, if Zion's running with a head of steam, like that might be quote unquote harder to stop if you want to think about something like that. But the thing with Jokic is, you can think about it in terms of the players and the schemes that you want to put on him. So there are other bigger dudes where, like, I mean, if you want to go back to Dirk or Kristaps Porzingis or, you know, wherever, okay, put a smaller guy on them, their handle isn't good enough, they can do other things. Or put somebody really big and they can't move them and something else is going to happen. Or they're a bad free throw shooter, so you can do Hack-a-Shaq or Dwight Howard and all that kind of stuff, and you'll take them out of their game. With Jokic, none of those exist, as I can think of it, and you know him, you know his game better than I do. Can you think of any?
Well, I mean, he's got to – the one thing is you've got to have enough, like, guys that can punish the double team, because I do think that what's going to happen in the playoffs, my biggest fear is that they're just going to send two and three bodies at him and really muck up like the cutting lanes, and then just dare Campazzo to shoot, and you know, some of the Aaron Gordon to shoot at volume and this or that, and just live with it. And when I say live with it, I mean honestly not even running out at those guys. And that's the one thing. But this, you're kind of hinting at what I'm getting at with the adaptability thing, which is in the like the macro level, okay, we're going to completely change our style of attack and we're this type of team now. It's almost like Tim Duncan had the early low post bruiser type player, and then later on they became the beautiful game, and you know, he was the fulcrum of that as well, just in a different way. Jokic is doing that in one season, but he also does it possession by possession, and that's what you're getting at. Like, you throw a big on him, okay, we're going to come up top and run pick and roll, we're going to do this and that, or I'm going to work the elbows, or if I have to, I'll post him up, but we're going to try other stuff, and you switch a little to him, okay, I'm going to go down to the block, I'm going to send a double, okay, I'm going to kick out, or I'm not going to double, I'm going to score. Just there, he just has he can adjust his game on the fly based on who's with him and who, how the defense is guarding him, in a way that is not quite 100% perfect yet, but it's more perfect than it's ever been in terms of he feels very confident in whatever situation you're giving him right now. And he's honestly unique in that he's less, maybe the funny thing about contrasting him to a Joel Embiid or even say an Anthony Davis or a LeBron James or someone like that is those guys are sledgehammers. The thing they do best, it's very difficult, if not impossible, to stop. But with Jokic, it's not that he's a jack of all trades, because he's better than a jack of all trades, but he's maybe less of a sledgehammer at any one thing. He's just so good at everything.
Right, and that has been, you've brought up the like adaptability, and it's not only the physical part. I mean, like being big, you know, even though he's much more slender than before, but just being a tall dude means that if you can, with the way that Jokic uses leverage and everything else, like he does a better job of attacking size mismatches than a lot of other players. But it's also being small, being a little bit thinner, and also just having a good handle and being an unbelievable passer means that he can handle some of those like strength and height and all the some of the speed mismatches, and that has really affected it. And like, I mean, one way of kind of describing, like, I had Jokic as a second tier most improved player, but I think part of what the argument would be for first is there isn't a great kind of calibrator for involvement within the offense, but one that your former colleague, my current colleague Seth Partnow, has brought up, like basically kind of the idea of total usage back, you know, when you guys were at Nylon Calculus together, is kind of like the way I kind of is usage combined with assists per 100 possessions is kind of a rough way of thinking about it. And so Jokic last year, I mean, take out that he's doing this for a center, just for a normal player, 27% usage and had roughly 11 assists per 100 possessions. And then he turns the ball about 5 times per 100 possessions. This year, ramped that up to about 30 usage, 12 assists, because assists don't count in usage as Basketball Reference does it. And then turnovers haven't gone up. They've actually gone down a little bit. So to be able to be, so he is a materially larger part of their offense than he was before. And that's actually a parallel with Joel Embiid. And then the other parallel that both these guys have is that they've done that. They've become a larger part of the offense, but they've done that while also becoming more efficient individually, which is incredibly difficult. And so for Jokic, I mean, the jump from being, you know, and again, this is only individual offense, from, you know, 16.5 true shooting to 65, even if this is a more favorable offensive environment, that is gargantuan. Like, that is game changing for the league. And not that every possession Jokic has ends in a shot for him, but to be able to convert those opportunities so much more regularly, making more threes, doing better from two, getting to the line more and making more from the line, like, all of those things are extremely important, not only for the Nuggets at full strength, but also at less than full strength.
And the foul shooting is an interesting one, because I mean, it's too small of a sample size. The last 10 games or so, Jokic has really started to get into the line a lot. And I'm really curious, just watching him, I'm really curious if he's sort of learning, like, okay, this is what they want to see to draw fouls. His finesse game, you know, I talk about this all the time. If you look at the guys who shoot the most in the paint but get the fewest foul calls, it's Valanciunas, it's Vucevic, it's Jokic. What do they all have in common? They're below the rim finesse post players. And that just doesn't, for whatever reason, just doesn't generate a lot of fouls. And I think Jokic is kind of learning, like, okay, there's he's learning better the balance between go up and try to finish this one and go up and try to get the contact on this one. And just the last 10 games, he's been getting double digit free throw attempts. And I'm curious to see if that holds going forward. You talked about his size and being skinny, though. One thing that I think is important with him, he has very wide shoulders, extremely high reach, and really wide hips. So as much as he has skinny and he's really trimmed down, he's not skinny in the way, you know, Giannis is skinny
or Nerlens Noel
or one of those guys. Like, he is thin, but he has just a wide frame. And when you put a PJ Tucker on him, Jokic's spin, because of how wide his hips are, like, his spin move forces PJ Tucker to shuffle his feet four times, you know, just to keep up with the width of him. And that's even different. I think maybe the closest comp to him in the NBA currently is Domantas Sabonis. But Sabonis, who's also really trimmed down this season, you look at him and he is just skinny. He has a skinny waist, he has skinny shoulders, low reach, and it doesn't have that same effect, that same ability to make teams like feel like they have to double or triple team him in the post. And that's one of the big things about him.
Yeah, that's a great point. And when you combine that with the skill level, like whether we're talking footwork or, you know, recognition and, you know, Jokic's mind for the game and everything else, and I like what you brought up in terms of recognizing the fouls. And one way that it's a weird parallel to draw, but I think you'll probably get the thread of this, which is intelligent players with physical capabilities that are bad at defense in college and sometimes in high school often end up becoming good defenders because they understand how the game works. And like Ben Simmons is probably the best modern example of this. Like Ben Simmons at LSU was a horrendous defender, but he was a horrendous defender because he never got into a stance and he didn't care. He was not a horrendous defender because he couldn't figure out what was going on or because he, you know, was a bad athlete or something else like that. And so with Jokic, I think the way that I would describe it, and I've seen a little bit of what you're talking about, I think you've seen more of it than I have, which isn't a surprise, is that when you have, you know, like when you have somebody who's thinking about this stuff a lot and who cares about it a lot and who is very adept at the different elements, mental and physical, you start to realize, okay, what is different about what I'm doing? What is different about what they're doing? And at a certain point, you go move away from the refs are out to get me and say, is there something structurally, tactically, physically that's different about it? And some players do that really early. Like, I mean, Trae Young has been a preternatural foul drawer since I saw him in high school. Like, that's just something that he's always done. But for some guys, just like how I talked about guys that are bad at college defense getting there, they haven't really put their mental and physical energy behind that because there's so many other things to think about. And I mean, for a center, you have Jokic's role on the offense, his role in the defense, and everything else. Yeah. But it's not a surprise for me, especially now that he's played more in the playoffs and you get the higher stakes, that could be something he starts to really think about more and maybe something that the coaching staff, the analytics group can start to put some video on. It's like, these are the things that get called. These are the things that don't get called.
Right. It's totally, I mean, I definitely think it's something Henry Abbott tweeted out a thing today about Jokic got the most last 2 minute report calls go against him in this season and over the last 5 year stretch of anybody in the NBA. And I honestly do think it's because his game is predicated on avoiding contact. And when guys do make that marginal, you know, hand on the hip or whatever, it affects him the same way it would affect a Damian Lillard foul line jumper. But those ones are expected. Whereas a post move, it's like, yeah, there's contact because that's how they play. I just think he's learning a little bit more. Like, I feel the hand on my hip. No finesse this time. Go into it. And then you'll get the foul call. But like I said, it's a recent thing. I'm curious to see if that continues and if he can continue to get, to get to the line. It seemed like such a point of emphasis. He had 17 last night, which is, I believe, a career high. So there's certainly a trend happening with him recently. The other thing about his value, though, and this one's a little bit more esoteric, but the one thing about him is if you look at LeBron James, James Harden, Luka Doncic, the guys that get lots of assist totals, their teams don't always average a ton of assists. And that's because I think a lot of it, the possession either, you know, almost always ends with them. One thing Jokic is very good at, and this is, you can't give him full credit because it requires players that also buy into this, but he's very good at getting out of plays, like setting the table for a play and then getting out of the way if that's what need be. Or, you know, just making a pass he knows will lead to the open pass. And you just see it so many times where it's like he could kick to the quarter and make a semi-contested three. three, or I kick to the wing and the wing kicks to the quarter and gets a wide open three. And he just makes so many of that. So you look at him and you go, okay, he's among the top in the NBA in assist leaders, but he also always plays on a team that's among the top in team assists. And when you see you know, Austin Rivers has joined the team and he's talked a lot. I highly recommend anybody that wants to understand this Nuggets team. I think it's pinned to my profile, an interview with Austin Rivers after a game where he's just talking about the culture that Jokic and the Nuggets have established and how it's unlike anything he's ever seen. I think that's another part of value that maybe it's marginal because it's hard to quantify, but it's something that is very real. That Jokic has led this to this Jokic and Malone and the Nuggets have led to this culture in Denver where guys really do seem to be willing to sacrifice. Michael Porter, high volume shooter, he's bought into the system. Like, all these guys have bought into sacrificing certain aspects of their game, and I really do think it's one of the things that people should look at when they look at Jokic.
The way I like to describe that is kind of the ecosystem, and that there are different ways that teams can succeed. And there are also, there are some offensive players that are more or less valuable. I think it's a shame that Harden has missed so much time this year because we kind of got to see both parts of it to an extent. I mean, we already knew exactly what he was in Houston. But and that's not to say that one approach is significantly better. There's also some elements that's just like, who else do you have? Like the Mavericks don't always have the greatest collection of passing around Luka, and you can get away with that. Sometimes you do that. I mean, we're seeing some of the challenges for the Warriors offensively, not having, I mean, the first like 15 games of the year when nobody else knew what was going on and they were just like not passing the ball and everything.
This is what's funny though, because I think there's something to this Warriors thing. One of the conversations around the Warriors of should they change their style of play dramatically because they don't have smart players that are capable of and skilled players that are capable of punishing it. But I think a little bit, yes, they have tailored their game and changed it a little bit. But I think part of this was it's hard to teach players how to play. You can't do it in 1 week or one month. It takes an entire season. And now you're looking at a Warriors team that is a much more fine-tuned guys understanding. Look, part of this is injuries. You know, Wiseman probably was going to take more than one season to kind of get this. And so injuries have maybe fostered it. Kelly Oubre went down for a long period and they played some of their best balls. So some of this happened with them. But I do think that I think people are too quick to say, oh, we have to change this. The best style of basketball is that is a more balanced approach. You're right that not every team can do it. And if you have a Harden or a Luka, it makes sense to keep the ball in their hand. But if you can foster an environment where every player is allowed the opportunity to flourish, you're going to have some bumps. And maybe it'll end up killing you down the road if you can't get over the hump. But if you do get over the hump, you do become the best version of yourself. And I think the Warriors are seeing that with some of their how they've looked better over the last several weeks than they did in the middle and early parts of the season. And I think Denver is another team that's just like that. Would it be better if you just posted Jokic? Probably early on when they couldn't get things going and it wasn't looking great, ISO, MPJ, run pick and roll here. But instead, over time, they've developed this ecosystem, as you put it, where the guys do just feel, you know, it's grown into a thing where all of a sudden Campazzo and Dozier and how many Nuggets players look like real players that coming? Shaq Harrison looks like a real player and he's been cut from two teams this season. So I think there's something about that ecosystem that brings out the best in players that are a part of it.
Yeah, I think you need to get players to buy in, but one of the easiest ways to get players to buy in is succeeding. You know, like anything else. And so, you know, the Nuggets making the conference finals last year. Also, I mean, they had a great offense long before that was the case. Before I want to talk a fair amount about Michael Porter Jr., but before that, Jokic's defense is obviously an important it's an important part of the conversation. Both, yeah, I mean, in terms of MVP, but also getting in stuff to best player in the NBA and all that. Do you feel like the criticisms, some of them have been levied by me and, you know, by Nate and other people, do you think of that as fair? Do you think of that as are there nuances that are being lost because you watch so much more of him than I get to?
I mean, no doubt. I mean, especially, you know, he's my friend, so I want everybody to know I can say this, but I think Nate Duncan's probably the, in my opinion, the most off base in his criticisms of Jokic as a defender. You know, and he's been pretty loud about that, especially this season. I've said this a lot. He's really bad as a last line of defense, like we're going to funnel everything to you. But that's not the only style of defense in the NBA. And I think we're seeing more and more teams that can succeed in different areas. And here's a take for you, Danny, that I've been kicking around a lot. And I think that it's becoming more and more evident as time goes on. I think we're actually overrating a lot the value of the rim protector and underrating a lot the value of the perimeter containment. And it's funny because the guy you compare Jokic to the most is Joel Embiid because, you know, oh, he's the two-way player, this or that. Embiid missed, I don't know, 10 games, 11, 12 games in a row, and the 76ers were dominant. They went up, I think, 7 points per 100 possessions. Yes, it's a small sample size, but they played the Clippers. They played some really good offensive teams and just completely shut them down because they have some of the league's best perimeter-containing players. And when you have a, you know, 7'1" shot blocker behind you and you perimeter contain, you end up with an unbreakable line of defense. But so often guys think, I think analysts and even just people, when you watch the game, you think of rim protector, like nobody can contain in the NBA. So we got a rim protector that deters everyone. And I just think those two things play in such perfect balance, but they're often always credited as one and not the other. The Nuggets prior, when they had Jamal Murray and Michael Porter, had really bad perimeter containment. I mean, some of the worst in the NBA. As they've evolved to having, you know, Campazzo and Shaq Harrison, it's funny that these are the guys they have now, but Campazzo and Shaq Harrison, you know, they've been a lot better at containing on the perimeter. And I think, you know, you're going to see a much better defensive team from the Nuggets in the playoffs this year. And a lot of that is Jokic, who has, in my opinion, a very Marc Gasol-esque ability to sort of play up the court and keep guys away from turning the corner. If they do turn the corner, you're cooked. But if he can keep them from doing that, he can be very good. So 2.8 deflections per game. That's about, I think it's top 20 in the NBA. It's right there with like a Draymond Green or a Kawhi Leonard. You know, he does a lot of things out on the perimeter with his hands that generate a lot of turnovers. He just doesn't block shit. He's bad at the most loud parts of defense.
He's also bad at the things that are the easiest to quantify, which is a functional challenge. I mean, like, yeah, that's what you're getting at with the rim protection. It's not only, you know, like, dessert. I mean, the argument, I think, the thing that's most, like, I think you brought up Embiid, and Embiid's a fine one to do is, I mean, Gobert is the defensive player of the year. But yeah, he's also, that's not why he's the defensive player of the year, but he's very good at those specific things, you know, blocking shots at the rim, deterring, defensive rebounding, like I think of them as the big man things. And it's true that when somebody is not good at those things, and Jokic, you know, defensive rebounding, I mean, I'll draw a separate line from that because Jokic and his teams have generally done very well in the defensive glass when he's been on the floor. So there's kind of two things here, one of which that I'm in line with Nate on, one of them that I'm not. Well, which is when you can't do that well, you have to do something else well. But there are other things that you can do well, and I think that's what you're getting at with the perimeter containment and everything else. And the one that I have been more on, and this is why I'm less high on Embiid as a postseason defender. I think we're going to learn a lot about him this year, hopefully. Hopefully we get to see the Sixers healthy and face some competition. We'll see what round that happens in. But for me, there's another line, which is how many different things can you do? And
yeah, totally.
how well can you do the like, so it's the idea of kind of like the severity of your strengths versus the severity of your weaknesses.
Totally.
And so I am less bullish on the centers that are really good at one thing, but can only do one thing.
Right.
And I'm not sure where Jokic fits in on that. I mean, I would say that he's not really good at any one thing, but that, and he's worse than his brethren at one thing. But the idea that that matters a little bit less, you're not going to have your guy around the paint. But so there's an interesting nuance here that I've been working my way around, that I'm not all the way there yet. And this playoffs is going to be very informative for me on this, which is the idea that it's possible center defense just matters less in the modern NBA. And I mean, I articulated this a little bit in the playoffs. Regular season is its own thing. That's a conversation. Right. But so basically there's this group of teams that you could argue, and I kind of would, that it started with the Golden State Warriors, even the pre-Durant Warriors, but it continued through that, which are teams that aren't trying to get all the way to the basket. And incidentally, the Nuggets, their offense functions in kind of a different way, but there's a part of it that's the truth that kind of ties in with this, where it's like, the reason you are efficient is not because you're pounding it at the basket in the half court. You're not getting all the way, or you're getting there, but you're getting there when the floor is open, and so it's not the same kind of shot.
Right.
And there aren't that many teams that can pull off that kind of an approach. You need unbelievable personnel. But the thing is, there are teams with that personnel. Like, and that's part of why I've been higher on the Clippers than other people at different moments in time. And this did not work out in the second round last year, is the idea that if you can be good at other things that are harder to take away, maybe that can persist. And like, that's a part of the Raptors offense in 2019 was this theory of the Warriors, but they had a lot of other things going on in the Durant years. And so the other part of that, and this is, and I just don't, I need to learn more before I can say that this is my belief on how basketball works, is if that is true, if there is this element, whether it's pull-up mid-range shooting, or there are a couple different ways you can describe it. I mean, you could honestly look at the Nuggets offense, you can see another one. If that's the way the league is going, then you can make an argument that in the playoffs, center defense is less important because there's just not that much they can do, which is a really interesting idea if I'm right. I kind of hope I'm wrong just because I think basketball is a lot more interesting if center defense matters, but we might be, I mean, maybe so it's just like the, you know, these really malleable, the Anthony Davises of the world that matter, but anybody below that, the highs and the lows are just a little bit less severe.
So I think you're actually dancing around what I consider to be probably the most accurate way to put this, and that is we're talking about adaptability, and Jokic is not adaptable on defense, and because if you can force him to become a rim protector, he just doesn't have it. I don't think he ever will. Like, he does some things well around the rim, but he's not going to ever be that kind of guy. The question is, can you build a team and a system around him that limits the amount of times he can do that? And I think the Nuggets have done a very good job of that. You know, they play him up in pick and roll. It's actually most bigs will drop or play a little bit below the screen or whatever. They bring Jokic all the way up because it utilizes his hands, and it prevents guys from turning the corner, you know, hopefully turning the corner on him, and it just takes away that rim protection moment from him. I think, you know, there are teams, though, that are going to be able to force him to do it. The Nuggets have lost two games. You know, they've barely lost any games since Murray went down, but two of the ones they've lost have been against the Golden State Warriors. Well, what can the Warriors do? You try to play up on Steph Curry, and he's going to cook you. And he's uniquely good at doing that to centers. And so with this Nuggets team, and I think it's true of probably every team in the NBA this year, it's not always true. The Warriors were a team that I think could adapt and beat anybody in any style, whatever, their heyday. And there have been teams like that. But I think the Nuggets are one of many teams that's like, if they get the right road and they play the teams that are not able to exploit that aspect of Jokic's defense, Jokic is going to look like a good defender. If they go up against a team that is able to exploit that aspect, he's going to look like the worst defender in the NBA. And so I don't think I would say that it's that center defense doesn't matter. It's just that, do you have a team that can take advantage of the things that center defense can't do well, and in particular, somebody that's bad at a certain aspect of defense from the center position?
That is a really good way to put it. And the first thing I thought of there was the Clippers. Like, the Clippers aren't great at turning the corner. Like, they don't have that type of a guy. And we wondered about whether they were, you know, getting into the mid-range, going to cause a ruckus. And they didn't really. And you think about that is, you know, you could argue is the counter to what I was talking about before about the Clippers and the older Warriors, where they didn't get to the basket all the time. It's like, well, then you're not taking advantage against the Nuggets in particular. In that circumstance, you're not taking advantage of what they're struggling at. And so what I wanted to do is just kind of game it out for you. So it looks like...
But hold on. I just want to, on that point, because I don't... This is a thing that just never got talked about, but I think it needed to be. If you go back to last year, obviously the Nuggets won. The Clippers, number one offense, I believe, last year, or top three. Maybe they're top three.
I think they're top three.
Dallas was number one. Top three. They get 101 points in game two. They get 96 points in game four. They get 105 in game five. They get 98 in game six, and they score 89 points. So they were held below 100 points three times and below 107 points five times. You know, I know the game was played at a slower pace or whatever, but you're still talking about a team struggling to score. And that's a top offense going up against a guy that everybody said couldn't get stops, and they were able to do it. And again, I think it's not because Jokic is this great defender, but it's because he's great at the things that the Clippers were good at offensively. He's good at stopping those. But if he were to go up against, say, the Utah Jazz like they did last year, and they don't have their backcourt defense, he's going to look cooked if Donovan Mitchell can go for 50. It's going to happen again this year, depending on who they play.
Yeah, I will note that was actually, I went back, I just went and looked. That was an impressively slow series against the Clippers. They were averaging fewer than 94 possessions a game, which in modern vintage is low. But yeah, the offenses were a little, yeah, you know, they did struggle in that. And you brought up the Nuggets too. So I want to game this out a little bit before we get to MPJ. The Nuggets probably going to be the four. Maybe they could get to the three. The Clippers have a pretty easy schedule. I think that they'll be able to kind of handle it, Bill. Very few teams can lose games that you think they're going to win, quite like the LA Clippers. So if you're looking at, you know, the five, six, seven teams, the teams that can be in that range, who do you think the Nuggets match up well against? Who do you think they would struggle most with?
I mean, there's no question they would struggle against the Lakers. I mean, the Lakers have not only just, I think, aggregate talent that's above Denver, probably maybe above everybody outside of Brooklyn, but they have defenders and bodies that they can throw at Jokic. And here's the one thing that I think was the X factor last year and will be the X factor this year, especially if anybody watched that Lakers-Knicks game last night. The Lakers have the ability to play very physical, especially inside. And that's where Jokic struggles the most. Not that he struggles against the physicality with it, but he's a finesse player. If you're able to sort of elevate the baseline for what a foul is in a series, then he's going to, you know, he's probably going to be diminished a little bit. And the Lakers are just very good at that. They've got Anthony Davis, who in clutch situations is going to probably be able to guard him well enough that, and then Jokic is not going to at all be able to guard him, that, you know, that matchup becomes a bit of a problem. So there's no question. It's the Los Angeles Lakers by leaps and bounds. And I would even say that the other two teams, Portland and Dallas, that you look at, it's coin flip. I think that I actually like Denver in both series. Don't love them. You know, we'll see how teams are able to sort of shut down Michael Porter or whatever. But Portland and Dallas are two teams that I look at and say, okay, those teams are on par with Denver. They're very flawed, as is Denver. And, you know, Denver has a great chance against both of them.
Yeah, I was thinking about your theory of the Nuggets defense, and Dallas is a fascinating component because if you think about kind of some of their base alignments, they don't really have great guys at turning the corner. Like that is something and they're a very Seth uses the term heliocentric. They're a very heliocentric team. You know, Luka has to do so much, Jalen Brunson when he's on the floor, but Brunson's, you know, more of a bench guy than anything else. And the Blazers succeed in a different way, but also their defense is unbelievably terrible.
Right.
I mean, it's been better when they've been able to have, you know, Covington and Nurk and some of the other guys on the floor. But Jokic will take his former teammate out to the deep water. And also the Blazers bench defense is just abysmal. And that would be a real, like, that is like an underappreciated storyline of their playoffs. It's just going to be like, now that they have these better starters, they're playing Cantor and Melo, and Nurkic is available. They're playing Cantor and Melo together again, and they've been absolutely getting caught on fire in some of those minutes, so that's going to be a challenge. And there isn't really a way to fix that. Like, just kind of have to do what you're going to do. But let's get to MPJ.
But one thing about Denver's bench is that their bench is elite defensively, but they really struggle to score. And so you get a defense in Portland that can't really get any stops. So it's the old movable object versus stoppable force or whatever.
Yeah, that would be very weird in a series between those two teams. And also, like, I think how Rick Carlisle, if it's the Mavericks, uses Jalen Brunson, because Brunson, I think if they primarily play Brunson in minutes when like Millsap and Jermichael Green are on the floor, I think he could run into some pretty big problems, because what Brunson, he doesn't really create a ton of separation. He has been this unbelievable finisher around the basket, but it's not like those guys are like super tall, but they are good defenders. And so will they be able to create enough advantage? Because the Mavericks at times have the limitation, which some other teams have, of not having enough kind of like capable dribblers and passers. And I think that could end up being a problem against Denver, both those series. Like if it's those two, absolutely fascinating. And the good news for Denver is that it looks preliminarily like those, the Mavericks and the Blazers are more likely than the Lakers. We don't know anything for sure as we record this on Wednesday. We'll have to see.
One quick note on Dallas, though. When the Nuggets acquired Aaron Gordon, one of the things I kept hearing was, have you watched him guard Luka? Have you watched him? He guards Luka better than anybody in the NBA. So, I mean, I have no idea if that'll hold up in a playoff series, but I do know that that name specifically, Luka, was a guy that they pointed to as he's just really good at guarding him. So,
Some intuitive sense. I've made the analogy before that, like, to me, the guys that are best on Luka, it's sort of actually like James Harden, where the better way to do it is with length, as long as you're quick enough to do it, because then you can, like, some of the stuff, like, that was, so the was Durant and Harden is where really this came to mind for me, was, like, you're not really going to kind of, like, stay in front of him in the same way, so you kind of want to be a little bit back and contest, Aaron Gordon's a pretty good player for that. He moves his feet well, and he's strong enough that Luka's not going to, like, knock him into the stand.
He's actually really strong. That's one of the things I didn't realize about him. But he's stronger even than what he looks, in my opinion.
Because he was a lot skinnier when he came into the league. I think that, like, there are various things where you have these holdover expectations, and I think that is one of them. You know, is like how strong a player is. And like Drew Holiday, for example, is a lot stronger now than he was when he came into the league. And so there are lots of those that it kind of. Players' bodies change, and sometimes it's not even in the ways that are as obvious, like Jokic getting a whole bunch skinnier. Like it can be your core is a lot better, or you've worked on all this kind of stuff. I mean, there are various examples.
Yeah.
So I remember you and I had a conversation, I think it was on your podcast, about a year ago, year and a half ago, might have even been before that, might have been in person, like the last time we saw each other. And we had this conversation about how the Nuggets shouldn't trade Michael Porter Jr. because Michael Porter Jr. was their ceiling. Because that he was, I think you're the one who said this well, and I've adapted part of it since, is basically the idea that, and I think even with Jokic's improvement, I think this is still true, that if they were to become a true like title contender, it was going to be Porter Jr. becoming something truly great that propelled them to that place.
Yeah. 100%. I can't say that I can take the dub on this one because we still don't know what Denver, you know, is with Michael Porter. And sadly, we might not know for a year or two when until Murray is back and healthy. But I think that this was one that the people that watched Porter just it, Porter reminds me so much of Jokic back in 2017, where you watch him every single you watch him one time and maybe you go, OK, he can make shots. But you watch him every time and you're like, wow, this guy makes shots like very few players do. And there's the aspects of the game that he is weak on are the aspects that are most likely for a player to improve on as time goes by. And again, they're loud defensively. Last year, he was a turnstile in the playoffs. And, you know, it wasn't until he got benched that the Nuggets started to win that series against Utah. And all those things were true. But what's also true is that's his rookie season. And what's also true is he had one of the most efficient shooting seasons last year of anybody in the NBA as a rookie. And if you just go through and watch the shots that he was taking, the degree of difficulty was higher than average. So he was taking an above average difficulty shot selection and was one of the most efficient players. And now that bears out this season, where you look at some of the stats you run through with him and you just go, wow, how many games does he shot over 60%? How many games does he have four threes or more? And then you watch those shots and you go, okay, some of those are wide open because of the offense, but a lot of them are not. He's just so tall and whatever that he really does look like the type of player that breaks defenses. The type of player, then obviously Steph Curry is the number one guy of this, but one of those players where it's like none of our schemes matter because to guard him means we have to compromise everything else. And if Jokic gets to attack a compromised defense, he's just so good. So Michael Porter, to me, it was very obvious from some of the very first games, like maybe the first month and a half where he got real minutes, that it was like, this is a guy that nobody you can trade for, realistically, you could trade him for, is going to elevate their ceiling like him if he hits. And now that he's starting to hit, I think everybody is coming to that conclusion.
Agreed wholeheartedly, and there was this scuttlebutt after the Nuggets played the Nets. Somebody, I think, asked KD about kind of the Porter Jr., and Durant made a point, which I would fully agree with, that they don't play very similarly. And I think with Porter, with Porter Jr., the best analogy I've heard is that he's not quite the same in terms of a couple of important elements that we might get into, but the better analogy is to Durant's former teammate, Klay Thompson. Like in that they do so much.
I want it on the record to say that I've been making this comp from almost like, again, like the second week of his NBA career. Yeah. It's honestly a more perfect comp than people realize.
It is. And so with both of them, there's this wonder about what they could do if they had the ball in their hands more. Like that we've periodically seen that with Klay. And I mean, I remember pre his injuries, I mean, I saw Michael Porter Jr. in person at, I think the first time I saw him was at the Hoop Summit. I don't think I got to see him at the like youth levels before that. And I was just like, holy crap, like this guy's just a destroyer. Like at that point, his on-ball game was really good too. His jump shot's always been clean. But the on-ball game, and we'll see. I mean, maybe that can come back. You know, like guys that you kind of start at the base and then you work your way back. But with Porter Jr., we'll see where the kind of the full end game motor is. But like when you release from where he releases from and the way that he navigates within an offense, it's so hard to take away. And what I think some people don't appreciate about Porter Jr. is that somebody who does what he does offensively, you could put in any system in a way that I think is more transferable than somebody like JJ Redick. Like Redick's a wonderful player, not trying to denigrate the dude at all. Part of it's because Porter Jr.'s taller, but another part of it is because there are just more possibilities. I think he's a much better transition player, for example, but also just I think that there are more wrinkles, and I think there's the possibility of more on ball that, yeah, MPJ probably not going to be a primary initiator, and I barely care about that at all. I think that he can do everything else well. He can and I'm very interested to see some of the finishing through traffic stuff as this game moves forward. some of that, but he, I mean, the tools there are just tantalizing.
Yeah. I agree with you completely about not knowing what he will become in terms of an on-ball creator, because he has a very, it's weird. His handle is not great, but it's very functional.
Yes.
Meaning he makes moves that don't, you know, pop, but he just always gets around his guy. And I think it's because he has such long strides and he's a little bit quicker than he looks because he's so tall, that he beats guys off the dribble, even good defenders sometimes, on, and you're just like, that wasn't even a move. He just kind of went around him. And I don't really know how it works. But then when he does have to make a complex move off of the dribble, he's obviously pretty raw at that. So I don't know if Kevin Durant has such a great handle that's both functional. He gets one step around you and he can score, but also like he can dance with the basketball and do some crazy stuff and score. And I don't think Michael Porter will ever come that close to having that good of a handle. But he also, the thing that he has that even KD doesn't necessarily have to this degree is he is a very quick jumper.
Yes.
He gets, when he goes into it, when he catches and goes into his jumper, you probably can't block it even if he was a slow jumper because of how high the release is. But the way he's able to get up to the top of his jump and release the ball, he's often shooting the ball before the defense has even caught up off of a screen, even if the screen wasn't effective, just because of how quick he is. And the fact that he's a 45%, now 44% career three-point shooter, 45% this year on 6.5 attempts, I've seen enough to say I think that's sustainable. I'd be shocked if he dips below 40% in any season, even at volume. And when you can elevate that quickly and shoot that well, I don't know that you need the Kevin Durant handle. You probably just need the functional one that hopefully he'll improve as years go on.
Yeah, and I wonder, like, when, sometimes when a player is so good at this but is also physically talented, I mean, go back to Porter Jr. being the number one prospect in his class in high school, is where does he want his game to go from here? Where does the coaching staff want his game to go from here? Because I don't think he's ever going to be like an insane foul drawer, but I could see him doing well there. And like, yeah, MPJ's, his numbers finishing around the rim are very good this year, but when I've watched it, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, I want you to me it's been more that his spots are more finishable. Like, he's shooting 84% around the rim, but I don't think he's done, I haven't seen him do a ton of that, like, around traffic. Like, he's doing it more like...
He has really good touch.
He does.
So one of the things about him is he's really got great instincts for getting open. I mean, you could tell he's been focused on scoring his whole life because he's a very good cutter, and he's a very good, like, second cutter. You know, he'll come off a screen. If it's not there, then he makes a cut. If it's not there, he cuts again. And he's just very good at sort of constantly being in attack mode. And because of that, he does get a lot of shots at the rim that are mildly contested. And he's just very good at sort of taking the contact, not finishing with a foul or with a dunk, but just finishing with like a hang in the air or adjust his body to a weird angle and finishing it. And he just has a lot of finishes that you're like, oh, I wasn't expecting him to go that route, but he did it and finished. So I think he actually will be a pretty good finisher around the basket, but I do agree that I don't know that he'll ever be a great foul drawer because of his style of avoiding contact.
Right. And maybe some of that changes when he's like 25, if he gets stronger and everything else like that. We've seen other players with his build turn a little bit, though generally they don't get too. Aaron Gordon, incidentally, is somebody that I've talked about in this vein before. And MPJ, not a huge surprise that he's been so effective in transition, especially with the league pivoting to more three-pointers in transition, but that's something I was getting at in terms of the difference between him and Redick. And yeah, some of it is Porter Jr. playing more in this era than JJ, which the things hadn't gotten all the way to that direction yet. But the way that MPJ can be successful kind of in the different phases of offense, and even though I think you can make an argument that, not in terms of volume, but in terms of efficiency, it's hard to think of a better circumstance for him to be in. There is a lot of malleability, and something that we've seen since Jamal Murray went down is that he can do really well with a larger role too.
Yeah, I'm pulling these numbers up as you speak because I've been hearing this one a lot, the role. And look, there's no question that you play with Jokic, you're going to be and you play in the system where he's been able to slowly learn the difficult aspects. I do wonder if he went to an Orlando Magic team and they gave him the ball right away, if the habits.
If he was like getting Chumo Kiki's, like the responsibilities that he's had for the like last couple months before he got hurt,
his game would not nearly be as well rounded as it has become in Denver. I mean, that's the biggest surprise to me, is that I just thought, okay, Porter's going to be a Carmelo Anthony type where you're just going to have to live with him doing his thing and whatever. But the opposite has been true. He's so willingly bought into, you know, fitting into the system. But here's the thing that I think will surprise people. Michael Porter's stats when Jokic is on the court, you know, this is 3-point percentage, 43.6. when he's off the court, 50%. Field goal percentage, about the same. His and the volume, if you look at it per 36 minutes, you know, obviously goes up when Jokic is not on the court. So he has actually been a really efficient player and scorer when Jokic was not there, when he's had to carry it. So I definitely agree in aggregate, but I think the degree to which that is true is probably a little bit less because he's just a great scorer.
Yeah, he is. I think that the malleability is an important part of this story. And I think that's only – it could increase with time. And there's no guarantee that it will. But I think – I say this a lot, but I think it's relevant. It was true with Jokic, too. It's like when players are really good, really young, my assumption is they're going to continue improving. Not linearly, not exponentially, necessarily. It can be. You never really know. Like, Luka's had a weird year for that respect and everything else. But good players find other ways to impact the game. Like, that is just it's just the way it works. And also the developmental energy and everything else. And when you consider that Porter Jr. faced the injury issues that he did, and you think about like where his game is going to go from here. And my basic answer is I don't know. Like I wonder exactly how it's going to be, and it could even be a circumstance where he kind of has two different roles. One when he's playing with the starters, and I mean especially when you get Jamal Murray back, and then he maybe especially if he wants this, if he prefers it, that you give him 5 minutes, 6 minutes with the other players, and he gets to explore the studio space a little bit more. And if he's good at it,
You have to earn that in the league, I think, right. Especially if you're on a veteran team. And I think he has, and that's the difference. Was he capable of doing this last year? Probably. If you played him with the bench and he shoots it, you know, 15 times a game, but they're whatever, like he probably would have been efficient there, but I don't know that a team and his teammates would have respected him to the degree of, hey, no, he went through, you think about the resiliency of him missing his college season, getting a second back surgery, then coming to a Nuggets team where I thought opening night, his rookie season, we're like, is he going to start? Is he going to do this? He didn't even play for the first 2 months.
Yeah.
We talked about him maybe being a starter and he didn't even get on the court. And then when he did get on the court, he played great. And then he goes back to the bench and then he gets benched in the playoffs and all of this stuff. Like he's earned his stripes. And I think you watch a guy like Jokic, who he's got the genius to him where he doesn't understand why other guys don't understand what he does. You know, like he's almost impatient for people that aren't as smart as him. You look at him early in this season, early on in Michael Porter's career, and he's just always throwing his hands up. He's so annoyed with him. Now Michael Porter will take a rush shot and Jokic will cheer it on because it's like he's earned the right to now be an aggressive offensive player.
Yeah, that's a great point. Where are you on MPJ's defense as of now?
It's funny because it's similar to Jokic where there's aspects of it that are really bad. He can't fight over screens very well still. I mean, everything to do with strength, he kind of gets bullied. He makes way fewer mistakes than he ever did before, but he's maybe 80% at being a veteran mistake-free defensive player. I mean, he just the complete like, hey, you were supposed to be the guy here. You missed that.
The way I put it is he's paying better attention now.
Yeah, and maybe that's it. Maybe it is just a matter of focus. I happen to think it's probably more – you know, these are just reps. Great players, especially veteran players, don't think the game. It just comes naturally to them. They're just reacting. And I think his reaction speed is speeding up now because the reps are getting there and it's just like, okay, there's a subconscious anticipation of what you're supposed to be doing on any possession. And he's starting to get there I'd say it's a work in progress, but it's nothing like what it was last year. I mean, last year he was an awful defender. The amount of improvement he's made just during the season this year has been pretty impressive, but the area that he's pretty great at is he's 6'10 and super bouncy. I mentioned that quick jump, not just the high jump, but the quick jump. He blocks a lot of shots where guys don't think he would get there in time, and he does. He just closes the gap so quickly. So he's become this good, like, shot blocking help side guy. I think he projects to be a good defensive player in the next several years.
Yeah, my instinct, especially given his limitations on screens, is that, and this was true before, but I think we're getting more evidence of it, that his best defensive position is power forward.
Yep.
But the thing that he's getting towards, and this is something that's come up a lot in like John Collins and the players, but Porter Jr. has better tools to play the three, is even if a power forward isn't a perfect defender, there are certain things that you want them to do if your defense is going to reach those thresholds. And I think the building blocks are there. And that's an important potential step for Porter Jr. And I'm not 100% sure that he's going to get there. I'm not 75% sure that he's going to get there. But I am more confident than I was before. And that is extremely important because now that he has worked his way into being an unimpeachable starter, I think Porter Jr. is going to make an all-star game soon. Now,
I do too.
Now his defense defense matters more, because like that, that is the, you have the privilege when you're limited or when your team doesn't need you to do much that they can go other directions. But once you're important, then it matters. And so that's something we'll learn a lot in probably in 2 weeks. I mean, that's probably the right way to think about it, about where he is. And you don't want to read too much into 7 games, 14 games, whatever it's going to end up being. But it will be a data point, that's for sure.
And I think that the Aaron Gordon addition really goes a long way to unlocking Porter as a defender, because Gordon has sort of the girth and strength, and just he's also just a great on-ball defender, to allow Porter to, regardless of what position he's playing, it allows him to guard a guy that's best suitable to his skills. If you only have one tall player, then like, okay, well, hey man, you have to guard Kevin Durant tonight because you're the only guy physically to do that. Now that you have a second one, you could say, okay, Gordon's got Kevin Durant, you've got the other guy, you got Joe Harris or whatever it is, and you know, now it allows him to more likely be in his comfort zone defensively and take advantage of his skills. So to me, it's all ecosystems. The Jokic, it's funny because Jokic Porter, like, okay, that's not a great 4-5. Jokic Gordon offensively, that's not a great 4-5, but Jokic Porter Gordon, it's like, oh, now all three of them sort of come together in a way that makes sense.
Yeah, and that was part of the theory of the trade, and I think something that the front office did really well. And it is such a shame that we're not going to get to see this fully operational for a while. I mean, with Jamal Murray, we don't have a timeline here.
Last thing on Porter, I want to say though, is just that he's insanely driven, and he came close. I think, I don't want to put words in his mouth because he stopped himself, because he does have, you know, one of the knocks on him is that he can be cocky, and I think he's cocky in almost like an innocent way. Like, he doesn't realize how cocky he is. But I think his goal is to be the greatest player to ever play. Now, that's obviously, we could all sit here and kind of laugh at that. But what I mean by that is he's an incredibly driven player. And when he's looked at his defense and the defensive critiques and accepted them and been like, they're right. Like, I've got to get better because I don't want to be just this guy or this guy. Like, I want to be the best two-way player in the NBA. And I just think it's impressive for a guy to actually have that goal and to walk the walk. He's not just playing lip service and then taking possessions off. Well, like, he's actually trying to become a lockdown defender.
It's so funny. I mean, you think about various other things in your life about, like, everything is good in moderation and bad in excess. It's like, ego is honestly the same thing. And, like, we've made the parallels. I mean, you're kind of covering a similar point in MPJ's career that I covered in Klay Thompson's. And Klay was, he needed to spend a lot of time working on his defense. That was something, and it was partially was an ego thing, and part, like, because he's like, I want to be a good player. But for him, it was also like, this is necessary for me to eventually be on a team that wins. And I don't think anybody saw what came coming, but that is, it is a part of it. And so whether it's you're a basketball, like, lifer and you want to get better because you're doing that, or it's because you're hearing people talk about you, whatever the motive, whatever the thing is. And that's part of why I think about how talented players often get better, is that, like, they have this motivation. And if they want to win championships or they want to be the best player of all time, really, wherever it goes. And there can be challenges. For me, the where you run into problems in terms of ego and cockiness and all that is when somebody plays selfishly. There can also be off-court stuff. I mean, there are murmurs, more than murmurs, about Trae Young with some of that stuff, like how that can come in. But when somebody plays selfishly, whether that be because they take possessions off or because they're not keeping their teammates as involved or anything else like that, and there are times, like, I've never thought of, like, players being unaware defensively as being a selfishness thing. Maybe if you don't continue to develop it, it can become that, but, like, you know, Anthony Edwards this year, I don't think he was a bad defender because he's, like, a selfish person or anything like that. He just wasn't good at it. And Porter Jr., I think it was more in that vein than anything else. And also sometimes, you know, like, it sounds like this came up in LaMelo Ball's interviews too, like, individuals can be wired very differently, and there are shorthands that people use that maybe because 90% of the time this thing leads to that thing, or these traits are shared or something else like that. But the problem with that is, and I mean, this is probably, I mean, beyond all the back stuff and everything else of part of why Mike Porter Jr. fell, is they aren't necessarily all correlated. And, like, you know, there's some stuff out, like, LaMelo Ball is kind of a weird dude and Michael Porter Jr. is cocky and all
right,
that. Like,
totally.
That isn't necessarily, like, they're not going to take the basketball seriously, they're a bad teammate or anything like that. And it's also the challenge of betting on something that isn't talent. You know, like, right. So with both of those guys, it was, like, undeniable tools. You could see the feel for the game in some ways in LaMelo's case. And in Porter, I mean, his feel is actually very underappreciated, I think, in certain circles. Like, because a lot of the guys who do what he does well aren't intuitive, but he is.
Mm.
But I think that those shorthands like, they can be a real problem. Because, because you have to remember that you don't get that many bites at the apple. And, I mean, Denver was fortunate that Porter Jr. Yep. fell to them. But getting that wrong, if you, like, there are a couple of examples that you can point to. It's like choosing or not choosing somebody primarily or at least significantly involving personality. Like, there are times that works out, obviously. Like, there are, you know, guys that are jerks and that it doesn't work out or anything else.
Totally.
But
yeah.
I think that in some ways that is a more dangerous game than some expect.
Yeah. Oh, and there's no question about it. And this is where culture, you know, also sort of sets the tone. You bring a guy in to where it's like, hey, if your best player is, you know, making himself, you know, do all of the difficult things and he's putting the teammates in front of him, like, it becomes easier when you're the lowest man on the totem pole to say, I'm going to do those things as well. But your point, LaMelo, Anthony Edwards, Michael Porter Jr., all I think have come into the league, you know, sort of in order or over the last 3 years. And all of them, the story on them has been, yeah, like, hotheads or not serious or this different things about them. And it's funny because you watch all three of them play and you think these guys are great, great personalities, great players, great, you know, whatever. And it is kind of funny. This is, I mentioned the Austin Rivers quote the other day. He was asked about Michael Porter specifically, and he said he had a great line in there. He said, this league is funny in how they determine who gets to be who. It, meaning, like, who's the villain and who's the, oh, he's the cocky one and he's the nice guy and he's the fundamental or whatever. And sometimes there is a real correlation there, but sometimes it really is just one comment or one tweet or one post-game scrum or whatever. And it's like, oh, you're the guy that criticizes teammates. Got you. You're the locker room cancer. And he's just saying of Michael Porter, he's not like that at all. And I honestly, the more I'm get to interview him and the more I get to just kind of watch him play and hear other people on the team talk about him, the more I believe it.
Yeah, it's absolutely fascinating. I don't want to necessarily end this on a down note. I mean, we got a lot of updates during this, but to me, there are lots of reasons why the Jamal Murray injury is crushing. I mean, one of them being the Nuggets were my favorite team to watch during that, you know, 2 weeks or whatever it was after the Aaron Gordon trade. They were one of my favorite teams to watch before that, to be sure. Yeah.
They were special, man. I know it's funny, and it's going to be that team was – I was really believing for longer than I'd ever believed before in the Denver Nuggets. I just was like, man, it all comes together for them.
But the thing that has me shook a little bit more, and you know my proclivities, is deservedly so, especially in Porter Jr.'s case because he's made so much less so far. Mm. Michael Porter Jr. and Aaron Gordon are in line for, in Porter Jr.'s case, a raise, in Aaron Gordon's case, a new contract, starting in the 22-23 season.
Yeah.
Jamal Murray and Nikola Jokic are already under contract. Yeah. And in some ways, it is actually more difficult to manage this financial situation if everybody is worth their contracts. You know, like, in a certain way, that's actually more difficult. And for those who know, like, the phrase that some people associate with me, because I did say it, is, like, ownership is the biggest competitive advantage in the NBA.
Yeah,
and
totally.
What has freaked me out to my core is that all of these players could be exactly as good as we hoped individually and together, and that actually makes it so that their shelf life is short.
Yeah. It's so true. I mean, building in the NBA when you're a team like Denver, it's so frustrating because obviously it takes time to build through the draft and you have to put in those years. And then by the time you're ready to sort of push your chips in, you get like 1 year before then the money doesn't make sense. But you know, you could answer that better than me about whether Denver could retain Murray, Porter, and Jokic. And, you know, would it be hard to build around? Sure. Like, you're going to have to really get a bunch of vet minimums and exceptions and rookies and whatever to build around them. But my thing is, those three, I think, offensively at least, complement each other in a way that you almost can plug and play. Like, if you told me a team that was Jamal Murray, PJ Dozier, Porter, Gordon, Jokic, and even Gordon, like, you look at and you think, yeah, he's a great fit because of some of his two-way things. But is there a defense-only version of Gordon that you could plug in there that would be just as good for Denver? I happen to think yes, because Gordon's shooting like 20% from three anyway, and you're kind of paying him as this like sub-star two-way player, but he's not for Denver at least. I just think you can probably get away with that. That's probably how you build a team. And then you have, you know, a good rookie off the bench and you have a veteran minimum off the bench and you got a Millsap off the bench and you just have a couple of those pieces. To me, the power of the big three makes enough sense that the guys you plug in there are the cheap guys, the Shaq Harrisons of the world and PJ Doziers of the world. that I think you can make it work if you're just willing to pay those three guys.
I think you can. It would be, in some ways, it would be a shame if they have to. But at the same point, you know, we deal with the world as it is, not the world as it should be. I mean, at a certain, to a certain extent, like there are certain walls that I have beaten my head against so much that I don't see the point in doing it anymore. I think everybody knows where I stand, and if, and I'm not going to, I'm not capable of changing it. If I could, I would, you know, like I want to see the best teams be together as long as they can. But I think that what you're getting at there is such an important point, which is that the importance of stars in many circumstances is the ability to put quote-unquote lesser players, whether you want to say more limited or more raw or however you want to put it, and still succeed. Like that is the, you know, like if you want to say, you know, Jokic, the ecosystem stuff we were talking about before, like how you can get into a lot of that. And the wish is always, and incidentally, it's generally in the modern era, it's those star players that also can bring other players into the fold, and that can make them either want to come or be happy and stay, however you want to make that work. And that is a very good thing for Denver overall. I mean, especially as long as these guys want to stick around. But it is a challenge at that point. So like the way that I would kind of phrase it is, as long as those guys stick together, their floor is exceedingly high. Yeah. And the capacity to spend, the way that I would put that is that it ramps up the degree of difficulty on the front office and on health. You know, like you have to have guys stay healthy and everything like that. And
yeah, the health thing. Yeah. But let me interrupt real quick, because isn't this what the Spurs did for 12 years? They had three guys and then they had three different eras because they shuffled the deck, the pieces around the three guys.
Yep.
And it even changed the identity, but your three guys were the same. And Tim Connelly, this is what he's been great at. He hasn't necessarily been great. You know, he found Jokic. That was big. And getting Murray at seven was big. Michael Porter was kind of a no-brainer for them. But the way that their team is structured, the way their front office is structured, they're willing to take long-term risks in ways that most teams are not. But what he's really been great at, if you step away and say Jokic a little bit of a fluke, because I think even he would say that, he's been great at finding Monte Morris's and Gary Harris's and just guys, even Will Barton off the dumpster pile and Facundo Campazzo. And that's what they're going to have to do going forward. If you have those three guys, you're going to have to keep finding Will Barton's and Facundo Campazzo's. And it reminds me so much of Boris Diaw. You remember Boris Diaw, how he got to the Spurs. He was in Charlotte and they just weren't playing him. They thought he was a terrible player and they hated him. And he wasn't. He just was in a place that didn't necessarily appreciate or understand his value. And you get him and you add him and all of a sudden he's one of the most important pieces of a championship juggernaut. And I think Tim Connelly and the Denver Nuggets are primed to be able to make those types of moves for the next 5-6 years if they're able to keep the big three together.
I'm optimistic about that as well. And it's also important that what to be able to flip some of those players, you know, the identification part. So the example that I use here, you brought up the Spurs, is Jonathan Simmons, where Jonathan Simmons was, you know, developed in the Spurs system, became this valuable defensive player, you know, 3 and D, but lighter on the three. Yeah. And the Spurs made a bet. I think he signed with the Magic. And they basically made a bet of, we'll do a better job finding another Jonathan Simmons than paying this one. And so they didn't end up getting assets there, but they ended up, you know, not having to pay him and getting into those logistics. And so at a certain point, and these often for a fan base can be, they're not as painful as certain things, but they can be very painful, is like, at some point, they're probably going to need to flip somebody like Monte Morris and find a different Monte Morris and pay him less. Like that,
might have already done that, though.
They might have.
I mean, Campazzo might be that guy. I think Campazzo might be their guy for the next couple of years and not Monte, as much as Monte has been a great piece of this team. And PJ Dozier, same thing. I mean, he's another guy that was cut from several teams, offered first at a two-way, and now he's a guy, I mean, he got hurt, but he was a guy that was probably going to start at shooting guard for this playoff run and be great at it. So this is what I'm saying. I think Tim Connelly is forget drafting Jokic, which again, I think was a little bit of a fluke. Tim Connelly's best skill is finding guys from the dumpster pile that fit the piece of the puzzle that Denver needs most. And that's Monte's a great example. Dozier's a great example. Malik Beasley was a great example. Barton was a great example. He just seems to find those guys that are second rounders or end of bench guys that are like, hey, but they have a skill set that can work here.
Yeah, and that is going to be exceedingly important for the Nuggets, whether they increase the willingness to spend or not. And hopefully that works out.
They better.
Yeah.
There's few – like, it's funny talking about the Kroenkes, because so often, like, people are like, it's 2014 and it's like, oh, why won't they go into the tax to do this? It's like, because that team's not very good and Gallo's out for the year. Like, what do you want them to go into the tax on a year they're at best a six seed? Like, it doesn't make sense. They're in a situation right now where over the next two or three seasons, we're going to know whether they wanted to win or not. There's no, well, it didn't make sense to do this or that. It's like, no, you have a team that is so good that if you are just willing to pay money for, they are going to contend and maybe even win one.
And
so,
where that money makes a big difference. Like, this is, yeah, that was the criticism that I levied at Tillman Fertitta, where it was like, if the Rockets had been willing to use their mid-level and go into the tax a little bit, they would have been, you know, it might not have swung a championship, but it could have.
Right.
And
right.
Like, those are the ones that drive me the most crazy. I don't want the, you know, mediocre Orlando Magic, or like, for example, like the trade that Karnishev has made with the Bulls. Like, I don't necessarily want those teams to spend aggressively. I want it that if you are a championship contender, or at least in the vicinity, and spending can make you better, I want you to spend.
And it's so funny too, because the draw between like going now or waiting or being patient or whatever, it's so much easier for fans and stuff to do. I do a podcast with George Carl, and it's funny. I love George. I think he's great. He provides so many insights I'd never would have thought of. But every time you present him with should you slow play and develop this guy or push it chips in for a player, every single time he's like, push in and win now. You don't know what you have. Like, go for it.
He's a coach.
He's a coach. And the coach mind frame is totally like, why worry about tomorrow when we can do something today? Even if the odds of us winning today aren't great, still push them all in. Push the chips in. Always push them in. And the Nuggets have found a nice balance of that. But going forward, there's just no question. You got to push the chips in, man.
Yeah, absolutely. Anything else you want to discuss? I'll open the floor to you, or we've talked plenty. We can end it here.
No, I think it's good. I mean, there was way more to discuss when Murray was back. I have a question for you, since you're not in Denver, and this is like a question that carries some baggage, but if you're in Denver, but when Jamal Murray comes back next March, and let's just assume he's fully healthy. There's no, like, I'm not trying to talk about integration time. Let's just say he's back and hits the ground running. How do you rank Denver's players 1, 2, and 3 in terms of just like value?
I mean, Jokic is 1. I don't think there's much of an argument there. So I would say right now, Murray 2, MPJ 3. But if I'm going to guess where MPJ is at that point, I think right. Porter Jr. might be number 2. And the biggest frustration, and I've had this with Jamal Murray forever, is the peaks and the valleys. Like, that's it drives, like, his capacity to have just nothing burger games is, you know, so it's not, the analogy could be to, like, and incidentally this came up with MPJ, it's come up with a bunch of young guys, like when he was a rookie, of the, you think about the 5 good games and you don't think about the 5 bad games. Like when, you know, especially like fans chesty and all that type of stuff. And it comes I could pick somebody for every single team over the last 5 years where that's been the case. Jamal Murray isn't like, he's way too good a player to have that happen as often as it does.
Totally.
And
even this year, there was, I mean, he got a little bit more consistent in the back half of the season when he was healthy, but the early part of the season, it was the same story. 10-point games, 12-point, you're just like, what happened?
Exactly. And so I also think that, you know, Jamal Murray, his defense can come and go too, but I think that that might be the next step for MPJ, is also like becoming a more consistent defender and all that. So, yeah. But part of why I love Murray on this Nuggets team is that if you can withstand the dips, and I'm hoping the dips get less extreme.
Yeah.
There is real value. And it's funny, like, we brought up Clay as a comparison for Michael Porter Jr. before. There is utility. There is something to having somebody whose highs are as high as his are. Because the idea is like, oh crap, like, this team is unstoppable. Like, those having that type of player on a team that has a high floor is actually really useful. And I think that like, for example, like, I think that's something different about, and we'll see where Jaylen Brown and Jason Tatum go with the Celtics. Like, the Celtics, Tatum has some moments now where he's that guy. But generally speaking, and this is a big criticism of mine of Aaron Gordon's last team, the Orlando Magic. Like, granted, the Magic were a way worse team in every way than the Nuggets have been the last couple of years. But those are sometimes the guys that make things really interesting. And so I'm really I think Jamal Murray's foibles would actually bother me more on a worse team. And incidentally, they might even bother me a little bit more on a team like a tier one. And maybe hopefully the Nuggets will be there when he comes back. But like, because then it's like, well, if you were more consistent, you might just be the title favorites. You know, like, you would take some of the ambiguity out. But I do appreciate having somebody that volatile on a team that sometimes can use a little bit of that volatility.
Yeah, I think And that's what's interesting about Denver is, you know, Murray has been so up and down, and Porter has been pretty consistent, you know, over this stretch, at least in terms of scoring. You know, just that you look at the numbers, he's 20 points or above in almost every game for the last 3 months. And that's just something Murray never really did. So I'm curious to see how that shakes out. When you are the point guard, the ball, you don't have to worry about the ball getting, you know, getting touches. You just naturally get them. That's one thing. I mean, this is on the horizon a ways, but it's one thing about how do they establish Porter versus how do they establish Murray next year when they all come together, because Porter has to be established with team support and Murray doesn't. And I'll be curious to see how that dynamic plays out.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you so much for taking time. Pleasure as always.
That was fun, Danny.
Yeah.
Thanks again to Adam for taking the time to come on. You can check out his work at DNVR, which is such a cool concept, and I'm really happy that it's working out well for them. And you can also follow him on Twitter if you don't already, Adam_Mares, ADAM_MARES. Love having him on, love talking with him, and thought the conversation on Jokic's defense in particular was really interesting, and there are not many people as intelligent and thoughtful for me in the NBA world as Adam, and the fact that he knows this particular team so well is a real lifeline for me. And I mean, I watch the Nuggets plenty, but to get that kind of insight from somebody who I trust a lot is really valued. Hope you enjoyed the episode as well. If you want to support the show, there are a lot of different ways you can do it. You can leave a rating, leave a review in the podcast player of your choosing, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, really wherever. And you can also tell other people about the show. Word of mouth is very important. And subscribing, downloading every episode is really useful. Real GM Radio will never come out on a specific day of the week. It is just when I'm available, when my guest is available. And so that means subscribing is a great way to have it just pop in your inbox. You don't have to see a tweet from me or something else like that. You can also check out my other work. Nate and I are done with the League Pass NBA cast because there are no more League Pass Mondays, and so we're going back to the kind of like call it the traditional NBA cast, and gonna have a new fun wrinkle with Hot Mike, but we'll have more on that at other points in time. And Dunked On still going on strong. Dunked On Prime Sundays/Mondays with Nate, that's the public episode, and then the other four, and we might be modifying the structure a little bit for subscribers because of the playoffs, and so we're gonna change the, we'll see if we want to change things around, but you'll get plenty of content for sure from us as the playoffs go on. I think everybody's used to that by now. If you have any feedback on the show, good, bad, or indifferent, DannyLarueNBA@gmail.com is the way to get to me. If you take the time to write it, I will take the time to read it. That is my promise. I try to reply. I do what I can, but and I do prefer email to other things because Twitter is pretty ephemeral and I get other kinds of stuff. So that could be more difficult. If you want it to be seen and ideally responded to, that's the way to do it. And that's enough for now. So heading into the playoffs, extremely excited about that. And the play-in will be a fascinating wrinkle, getting to see the kind of the full vision of what it can be, both conferences, probably some really awesome matchups. So looking forward to that. And then the whole enchilada starting a week and a half from now. And it's going to be a challenging, a fascinating playoffs from round one on. And I'm looking forward to it. Thank you so much for listening. Take care and make it a great day.